Help support KBOO Community Radio by donating your used car, truck, motorcycle, boat, or any other vehicle. We'll transform that old machine into resources for unserved and underserved communities, free training, recording equipment, and great programming for the Portland metro area, Cascadia, and the world. For more information, call 1-877-526-6123. That's 877-KBOO-123. Or go to kboo.fm/vehicle.
Tune in to KBOO every weekday at 7 p.m. for Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective with Davey D. Hard Knock Radio features in-depth interviews and profiles with community leaders, activists, hip-hop artists, and musicians, giving voice to community concerns and offering a unique forum to explore issues relevant to hip-hop community. That's every weekday at 7 p.m. here on your community radio station, KBOO Portland.
Welcome to Between the Covers, a weekly KBOO program featuring interviews with authors of fiction and nonfiction. I'm your host today, Leanne Kronz. I recently sat down with Pacific Northwest writer Megan Cruz to talk about her debut novel, Call Me Home, published this month by Portland-based Hawthorne Books. Megan Cruz is an award-winning and widely published fiction and creative nonfiction writer. She studied creative writing at Oberlin College and earned her MFA at the University of Montana. In 2005, she received an Oregon Literary Arts Fellowship. Her essay, The Trailer, was published in Portland Queer, Tales from the Rose City, which won a 2010 Lambda Award for Queer Literature. Her short story, Dollywood, is one of 100 other distinguished stories listed in Best American Short Stories 2011. Megan Cruz's debut novel, Call Me Home, delineates what happens within a nuclear family with an abusive father, how domestic violence can draw a brother and sister closer than twins, cause a daughter to make a glass sandwich for her father, a son to betray his mother for his father's approval, and a mother to blame herself for it all. The freedom and isolation of the American West is a dangerous country for abused women, gay sons, and emerging daughters. Violence looms like the clouds. These characters keep their secrets and wait for what feels like a lifetime for their chance to be free. Here's my conversation with Megan Cruz.
Welcome, Megan Cruz.
Thanks, Leanne. Thanks for having me.
Thank you, and congratulations on your first novel.
Thank you.
In the letter that accompanied my advance copy of Call Me Home, you wrote, "The novel that you're holding is a story I've been dreaming since the first moments I can remember, growing up in a desolate, forested corner of Washington State. Why were you so compelled to tell this story?"
Well, I think that, you know, this story, if I look at it, it's sort of the culmination of at least 10 years of my writing life, where I've always been drawn to places that were, you know, vistas and geographies that weren't part of the canon of literature that I was reading, even as I was studying contemporary literature. I was drawn to stories of, you know, queer stories and queer narratives that didn't have a place in literature in the way that I wanted to see it. And you know, there have been just different pieces of my life, my work, the things that I have followed, and you know, I'm really sort of weaving those together in this family. And I think even more than that, I've just always been sort of pulled towards stories that are greater, I always say greater than the sum of their parts, because, you know, if you look at any of these three characters, and my book is told in three voices, they're sort of braided together, and that's the mother, Amy, her 18-year-old son, Jackson, who's gay, and her 13-year-old daughter, Lydia. If you look at any one of their narratives, you know, they exist inside their solitary frames of reference, and you know, they obviously inform each other, but I think, you know, as a reader from the outside, you can see so much more completely the story of what has happened to this family, and you can feel those intersections and those, you know, the losses and the triumphs more completely, because you see how they echo through the entire family. So I think that, you know, and I also have just really always been, you know, I think I grew up when thinking, always everyone would ask, what, you know, what if you could have a superpower, what would it be? And the superpower I always wanted was to just have a little scale that told me, like, if I made a decision, if it would be a net positive or a net negative in my life and future. And I just think, you know, if you go through life and you know, these choices that you make are, you know, they conceivably determine your path. And I realize that, like, that can be a beautiful, beautiful thing. But if you are left to reckon with that question, if you have children, if you are, you know, making decisions that really affect and impact other people in a very concrete, tangible, and identifiable way, then, you know, that reckoning can be so difficult. It's this ledger of what you've done in your life. And I think, you know, I've been fixated with that concept my whole life, with the concepts of regret and guilt and how we ensure our happiness and how we feel like we're sort of echoing on the people around us. And so I think, you know, that was sort of the bigger themes that I was trying to get at.
As you say that, I think of the mother character, Amy. She not only was the direct target of her husband's abuse, but she carried so much guilt and took responsibility for it all. And she actually also had to take some anger from her children. I mean, she was getting it from all sides. It was so poignant how she wanted to get them out of there. She would tell them, don't lose faith in me, you know, be patient, you know, be brave. And it was just, I was really touched by her. She carried so much. You really did a masterful job of conveying
that. Thank you. Thank you. My hope for people who are reading that is just to see, you know, how desperately she wanted to give her children a life of beauty and happiness. And I think, you know, she's moving towards that, but there are difficult decisions. And I think that anyone who survives violence or abuse has to make those kinds of decisions, because someone has chosen to walk into their life and sort of put themselves down in their path and divert it from what they would have chosen. And I think, you know, she is faced with a lot of difficulty. And I do think that there are so many women who they become the sole bearers of that ledger that I was talking about, that inventory of your decisions, because, you know, people they don't see the abuser. The abuser often is the one who has been left behind so they can start a new life. And then we look at them and say, you know, how have you done for your children and how have you done for your family? And that's such a difficult thing to have to take that on. And I think to any extent, anyone who in a relationship or a family or a group bears that, some of that weight of what, you know, what decisions have you made that have changed my life? But for Amy, you know, I just have so much compassion for the decisions that she's made. And I don't know if they're all right, but I know that, you know, I was just really compelled to tell her story because of that, because I think, you know, she walked into her, you know, she left her home in Texas with her abuser, who she didn't, you know, that wasn't how she perceived him at the time. And she walked into a life that she was hoping would be full of promise and beautiful. And to be 20 years down the road and realize that you have fought tooth and nail to protect your children and, you know, it's not always working, I think is just, it's a heartbreaking moment. It's a heartbreaking thing to have to reckon with. And so I just have a lot of compassion for her. And I hope that it comes across that this is a story of hope and redemption, that she is trying, you know, they are all trying to take this, you know, these ashes of what he's kind of, you know, how he sort of burned their family down and, you know, grow something in it and make something of it. And I hope that comes across.
Yeah, it does. I mean, the children clearly love their mother and see her beauty, and they don't lose faith in her, really. They don't. They seem to just be waiting for their chance. And in her defense, she does try many times, several times, to escape. And I think that's, she never lost faith in herself. It's really, she's a great character.
Thank you. Yeah, I definitely move back and forth with her in time more than the other characters. And I think some of that is I wanted the reader to see her as, you know, to see the pieces of her life that had led her there and how so many of them were things that she had walked into with these beautiful intentions, and, you know, how much this person promised her and how much she was trying to create a life that fit her. And, you know, I think often we just look at where people are in their lives and we don't see the steps. We assume that if you're not in a wonderful place, you know, that you've made poor decisions to lead up to that. And it's so much more complex than that. Mm-hmm. And you can never, I just think, you know, we really owe everyone the benefit of the doubt of assuming that you have made the best choice for yourself and for the people around you at the time. I think a lot of that gets lost in our perceptions of each other.
Mm-hmm. The children and the teen son, Jackson, and the 13-year-old daughter, Lydia, they aren't the direct targets of the physical abuse, but it's hitting them. And the mother, Amy, sees that. And that's what keeps driving her to get out. Can you talk about some of the ways Jackson and Lydia were impacted by this abusive father?
Well, I think that, you know, they Jackson in particular has, I talk a little bit about how Amy hasn't feared for him in the same way as a target, because he, you know, and he's obviously a target of his father's vitriol and condescension. And but physically, I think that his father's lack of, you know, his father's fear and lack of understanding about his sexuality has created a sort of a safety distance between them, or, you know, a distance that provides him a degree of safety. Whereas, you know, I think as Lydia gets older, Amy starts to fear that she's going to become a target. But, you know, their lives, Lydia lives in a world that has been so impacted by violence that I think some of her, the way that she lives, you know, she's a very internal, very just composed child in a lot of ways. And, you know, I think a lot about how they're both so young and old at the same time. Like, they're grappling with these very adult things at the same time that they haven't had the chance to really sort of unfurl their limbs as children even. And, you know, I think that the biggest, I'm also very fixated on the idea of, you know, the sibling relationship and how it's the, you know, if you grow up in a place where you aren't, you know, where you just have a nuclear family, or you're in an isolated area, your sibling is the person, is the only person in the world that can get the closest to knowing what your experience is. And I think that they in particular, they're the only people in their lives who really know, you know, and Amy can't really know what their experience is either. And I think one of the biggest ways that it's impacting them is that Jackson is serving as a shield to Lydia. He's serving as her safety keeper, as her, you know, protector and her guardian, to you know, both to his detriment and in some ways to Lydia's, because she is, you know, she is becoming so sort of dependent on his protection, and he has not, you know, he's not at the place where you should be when you're 18. He's sort of come to terms with the fact that he's going to continue protecting his sister until she leaves the home. And that, you know, creates, like, for Amy, that's a really devastating thing to watch. But at the same time, I think she's grateful for it. And so I think that, you know, it's impacting everyone all at once. And at some point, I answered a question about why, you know, if I'd ever thought about giving Gary the father a voice. And I just, you know, I don't believe he deserves one. He's obviously has made a choice, but like when you are writing a character, you're inviting the reader to identify with them and to, you know, feel for them. And I had no desire to give him that.
So. I get that. We're speaking with Pacific Northwest author Megan Cruz, and I think this might be a good time for you to read from your debut novel, Call Me Home.
Great. Yeah, I would love to. I'm going to read a passage that is sort of in the, it's in the first half of the book, but it's sort of a refrain, a reflection of Lydia, the daughter, and from when she was a little bit younger, and she's just sort of reflecting on her relationship with her brother Jackson. And, you know, the way that they were living, they live in a, on a lot of land in Tulalip, Washington, and they spend a lot of time just in those woods, steering clear of their father and, you know, building their relationship. And the woods become almost, I think, this is their home. It's their place of safety and protection. And both Jackson and his mother, as much as she can, are, everyone's sort of trying to protect the daughter and keep her from, you know, keep her feeling happy and keep her feeling loved. And this is sort of her reflection on that. And I think you can see how, as with any situation of abuse or violence or you know, any kind of trauma, we think we can cushion the people around us. We want to cushion the people around us and protect them. But nonetheless, you know, Lydia knows more than anyone would hope she would. And, you know, I don't think that Jackson or Amy, I don't think they're fooling themselves that she doesn't know, but there is that, you know, I think this scene sort of shows the way that it is impacting her as well. So in this scene, she's a little bit younger. Lydia, Tulalip, Washington, 2005. We built forts. We built little homes from blowdowns and stands of alder. We sat crouched in nests of sword fern eating red huckleberries. We took off our shoes and wrapped maple leaves around our feet like moccasins until they tore. And then we walked barefoot through the black piney loam and leaf fall. Our skin stung from nettles and the air smelled of skunk cabbage and rain. We followed the creek and knew each of the ponds that pooled beside it. We ruined our shoes. We collected sticks and handfuls of dry pine needles from the pockets beneath roots and rocks where they were shielded from the rain. We made rings of stones and tried to light fires with the sticks, the dry needles, the paper and lint in our pockets. The fires smoked and our old hall passes curled under the lick of flames and then went dead. We used our thumbnails to split the blisters on the trunks of pine trees so the pitch spilled out and stained our palms. We told stories about the wolf boy who lived in the woods and the fire trail ghost who would run beside your car and grab you in the dark. We told secrets. Lydia, my brother told me, the way that girls feel about boys is the way that I feel about them. Like I might marry a boy someday. Like gay? Yes. You're a homo? I asked. Yes, he said. I thought for a minute. Jackson was looking at me. His hands were shaking, pulling an alder leaf into pieces and letting them drift to the ground. I understand, I said, and I did. Between us, we knew everything already. We practiced survival. We stripped the leaves from fireweed and chewed them to a bitter cud. We found tangles of blackberry and drank straight from the creek. We sat in an old rowboat that was abandoned in the woods. In heavy rain, we turned it upside down, curled underneath it in the dirt and salal. We lured a stray dog through the woods with pieces of stale bread and talked to him in low voices. He was skittish and thin, and we named him Green for his eyes. When we whistled for him, he would appear, a moving shadow between the trees. When we touched his fur with cold, careful hands, we knew that he was meant for us. When we heard voices from the house, we went deeper into the woods and looked for bleeding hearts and trilliums on the mud-slick slopes on either side of the creek. And when we found them, we did not pick them. We knew how rare they were, how beautiful, and how quickly they would wilt in our hands. "I hate him," I told Jackson. "I wish that he would die. I wished he would go to jail. I wish he would move far away and never come back." "Sometimes," Jackson said, "I still love him." My brother could look so sad sometimes. "But I don't think I should," he said. "I imagined that if our father disappeared, then we would move into the forest, Jackson, my mother, and me. We would have the whole woods and the creek, and the leaves would flash and spin around us. We would have everything. In spring, when the brush was thick, we followed the creek for 3 miles to an old trailer camp. The trailers were empty in the winter and maybe all year round. Through the windows, we saw the dirty kitchens, the stacks of books, the bare mattresses. I imagined that each one was a different life waiting for us. I imagined that somewhere in the woods I would find the right one. Imagined that it would find me, that it would call me home. If it was a good day, our mother would come into the woods and crawl into the fort. She would pour us invisible coffee from the curl of a leaf. I was 8 years old. Jackson was older, and I understood that all of this was for me, and that my brother was better than most brothers. I drank from my leaf, lying in the crooks of their warm arms. "You were born for just this," they whispered. They held me between them. "You were born for happiness, for great things. You were born so we could love you."
That was Megan Cruz reading from her debut novel, Call Me Home, published this month by Portland-based Hawthorne Books. You know, that love that Jackson has for his father, that love-hate, caused him to do something that ended up making it impossible for Amy to take him with her when she finally did escape with Lydia. And Jackson can't forgive himself, can't understand why he did it. So can you talk about how Jackson's relationship with his father made him do what he did?
Well, I think the event that you're talking about is that during, you know, Jackson and Lydia have fled with Amy several times, and Gary's always found them. And, you know, they make a move where it seems like things are going to be all right. And Jackson's 18, so he has the ability to kind of, you know, to move through the world more freely than his younger sister. But he ends up in sort of a moment of weakness, betraying their location. And so Gary comes and finds them. And, you know, I think there's this question of, like, why would he do that? But you think about yourself as a teenager, you think about any trauma that people have experienced. And, you know, sometimes we make choices in those moments, especially when we're 17, 18, that, you know, we look back on and it's, you think, why, you know, like, why would I have done that? But he is, you know, in this moment, his father has hit his weaknesses and he's seeking his approval, and he spent his whole life both hating his father and wanting badly for his father to, you know, to love him and express that love for him, you know. And I think there's a scene later that I just think about, cite my own scenes, but, you know, where he's little and he just keeps, you know, telling his father, I love you, you know, and it's like that fear of, like, already knowing that you're holding, like, you can't hold on to something and you don't have that power to elicit that love back in the way that you need it. And so, you know, he sees his father and his father hits all these weak spots. And there's this moment that sort of causes their fracture of their family. And I think that's the major moment that this book takes off from, is the fracture of Amy and Lydia needing to leave on their own, and Amy hoping that Jackson will be able to leverage that awful event, but to leverage that freedom to create his own life. And he does end up in the mountains of Idaho, working on a construction camp, and he ends up in a relationship, or an affair, I guess, with his married crew foreman, a man named Don. And, you know, that relationship is one that is very unhealthy. Jackson, this is the first time, you know, he's been an escort before. He's had some sort of slight flirtation, but this is the first time that he has felt love and attraction. I don't parallel those things with his experience with his father. I think that, you know, he's very secure. He's always been very secure in his sexuality. And, you know, I don't think that Don is I don't intend for him to be a stand-in for, you know, some sort of figure who's giving him that kind of, you know, attention. I don't intend that at all. But what I do hope comes through there is the way that if you have grown up queer in a place where there's no community for you, think of my own experience and coming off of years of thinking, maybe there's no one for me. Maybe my heart doesn't work. Maybe, you know, maybe I won't ever experience that. And so you're coming in late to the game, and you're maybe 18 or 19, and for the first time you feel something towards someone, and maybe they feel it back. I think it is impossible to underestimate how powerful that feeling is and how desperately you'll want to hold on to it, despite how unhealthy it is. You know, and you can be, I think, you can have a straight relationship at 16, and you know, you look around you and there are so many people that perhaps you feel things towards who have the propensity to feel them back to you. And I think, you know, I'm not saying it's easy to get out of unhealthy relationships or bad situations in those scenarios. But I do know that to be in a same-sex relationship when you are young is to have, at least in my experience, a breathtaking sense of relief that you can enter into the world where people are transacting love. And for Jackson, you know, that he finally is having those experiences, and he, you know, he has been doing sex work and he's been in sort of an exploitive relationship with another classmate, and to finally have someone who gives him that, you know, that he feels that strongly towards. And then he tells him, you know, Don tells Jackson he's married. And, you know, how could you not forgive Jackson for not thinking, well, maybe I can handle it. You know, maybe I can stick around, because
he'll leave her.
Yeah, because it's, you know, it's his first thing. And it's just like you come without these tools into those relationships at a later age than if you were in a straight relationship. And so I don't know. I guess that was an important story for me to tell, just how, you know, how Jackson deals with that, and the complication of knowing, you know, knowing you're not being treated well, knowing that this isn't where you want to be, but wanting it so badly and not wanting to go back to a lonely place where you can't, you know, there's no one else in the construction camp that Jackson can envision just, you know, going out with on a Friday night or something. So I think, you know, that sort of the loneliness of being different in a place where it's not safe for you to be yourself, I think that was important for me to try to show. I think a lot about how to be born into a place where there isn't a narrative for how to be queer is to be born almost lonely, or to live lonely, I guess, because, you know, as you're coming of age, you know that to have the life that you want is going to necessitate you leaving. And I think that's something that Jackson lives with, and that for Amy is a way that she can give him a little bit, you know, she can maybe give herself a little bit of solace, is to think, I've set him free and now he can go live the life that he's meant to. Whereas if he's taking care of his sister, if he's taking care of me, then he is also left in that position of not being able to live his true life.
We've been speaking with Pacific Northwest author Megan Cruz, reading from her debut novel, Call Me Home. Megan, where can folks come and see you read in town?
Portland area events include on March 17th, I'll be doing the Unchased reading series at 7:30. So excited about that.
And
thanks to
series.
Jenny Forrester for that one. March 18th, I'll be at the Barnes & Noble in the Tannisbourne Barnes & Noble in Beaverton. And that's at 6 p.m. Broadway Books at the end of May, May 28th at 7 p.m. So you can get a full list of the tour at the Hawthorne site or at my website, which is megannicolecruz.com. M-E-G-A-N, Nicole, N-I-C-O-L-E, and then Cruz, which is K-R-U-S-E.
Well, thank you, Megan Cruz, for being our guest today on Between the Covers. I'm really happy for you.
Thank you so much. It's really wonderful talking with you, and thank you.
It's a beautiful book.
Thank you.
That
so
first
much.
Chapter just was perfect. Yeah,
it means so much to me to hear that. Thank you.
And thank you to Liz Crane and Rhonda Hughes at Hawthorne Books for making this possible.
Yes, 1,000 thank yous to them. My heroes.
Yay. And thank you for listening to KABU. I'm Leanne Kranz. Stay tuned for Words and Pictures.
Good people. Stay tuned every second and fourth Thursday at 8 p.m. for Guess Who's Coming to Radio, a show with music and discussion, addressing socio-political issues relevant to African peoples in this nation. We encourage you to call in with some positive, proactive solutions to what we are facing today. Guess Who's Coming to Radio every second and fourth Thursday at 8 p.m. on KABU, your community radio.
Looks like these kids are going to have some fun, doesn't it?
KABU Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of PDX Cocoon and their first public storytelling event on Thursday, March 12th at 5 p.m. at Lola's Room in Portland. The theme of this first storytelling event is risk. PDX Cocoon is a student-led group that is working to facilitate storytelling for Portland youth through workshops and events. Again, that's episode 1, Risk, by PDX.